Hey, y'all. How's it going? All right, well, good. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. My website is scotthorton.org. You know what I should say? Here, live, noon to 2 on the Liberty Radio Network. Which might mean on the radio wherever you are, or might mean on a website wherever you are. LibertyRadioNetwork.com. LRN.FM. I like LibertyRadioNetwork.com better because it says right what it is in the URL. But anyway, it goes to the same place. LRN.FM. That's where you can hear the show. And you can go to ScottHorton.org. That's my website. You can find all my interview archives there. You can sign up for the podcast feed of them, although the iTunes one is broken, something, trying to get them to answer me back. Yeah, that's a good idea. Wait right there, I'm writing a note to myself. Alright, yeah, scotthorton.org. Join up the chat room, hang out with the boys in there. Hey guys, good to see you. It's scotthorton.org/chat. Fake name and a captcha, and you're in. Also, it's a free node, IRC free node chat room, hashtag Scott Horton Show. So we can do that. Yeah. There's, 3,900 and something interviews there at, scotthorton.org if you like interviews about foreign policy things. About a decade worth. Wait, what year is it? Yeah, something like that. More than that. 12 years or something. All right. Anyway. So there's that. Tonight, I'm going to be hosting the second episode of The Future of Freedom with Jacob Hornberger on Liberty.me. So sign up for Liberty.me. Although, I think you can watch that show without being a member of Liberty.me, honestly. But I might be wrong about that. But anyway, tonight's show, I'll be interviewing Jacob Hornberger about things. I think you'll really like it. Well, he writes a lot of stuff, so there's always plenty to interview him about. So that'll be good. That's tonight at 8 Eastern Time on Liberty.me. Oh, and guess what? I tried to call him this morning to find out more about this, but apparently Tom Woods has a new show on Liberty.me as well. And Tom Woods' show starts at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And I guess, I presume that it goes from 7 to 8. Maybe it's only from 7 to 7:30. I don't know. I presume it's an hour long and it's right before my show. So cool. I hope, Jacob and I get some of that leftover Tom Woods traffic. Wouldn't that be nice? So see you guys tonight at Liberty.me. All right. That'd be cool. Also, today at 5 Eastern, for Texas time, I will be interviewed by Christopher Cantwell on his show, which, now that I think about it, I guess I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure it is right here on the Liberty Radio Network at 5 o'clock today. In fact, I could check that by clicking on this tab and then by clicking on that link. Let's see if I don't know. I think so. I thought so. Anyway, Christopher Cantwell's show, I'm going to be on because he wants to ask about Syria. And boy, do I have some complaints about Syria to complain about. So I'll try to take it easy on his audience and just keep it real simple. It's all the American government's fault for the following reasons. That kind of thing, so that they can understand. Should be fun. And, that's almost all I have, as far as housekeeping stuff is concerned. But, since today is September 10th, I guess I will go ahead and, remind you that today is the 14th anniversary of me getting rear-ended by a Suburban in my little green pickup truck 14 years ago. Today, it really kind of hurt my neck, but it healed straight and I'm all right, you know. toss my little truck all the way across the intersection into the turn lane on the other side. Good thing there was nobody coming that way or trying to turn left or anything like that in my way. Ended up landing on a blank spot of pavement. All right. Truck was totaled. Insurance company says, oh yeah, look at that frame. It's bent. But here's the trick. The frame is bent behind the back tire. So who cares? I mean, it's pretty damn bent, but it doesn't matter. And so the truck was already, whatever, say, 7 years old, 6, 7 years old at the time. And I've driven it another 14 years since then. Market value, nothing. You have no idea how many times guys, you know, work crew guys have come up to me in parking lots and even knocking on my door. Hey, you want to sell that truck? And they only want to give me a few $100 for it. And meanwhile, I've gotten years out of that truck. Well, it's a Nissan. It'll probably run for another couple hundred thousand miles. Well, at least one more 100,000. It is 20 years old, but it's in great shape, man. I think they built it on a Wednesday or something. So, never forget that. Forget the law, man. Go ahead and run the light if the alternative is getting hit by a Suburban. You know what had happened? Is I had just gotten a ticket the other day. So I was double extra worried about the state watching me. Oh no! Yellow light, red light, oh, bam. I mean, and they say, hey, keep safe distance. Don't be distracted by your telephone and all these things. But, so it was technically his fault, but it was my fault. What was I doing stopping at that light? I absolutely should have ran that light. He absolutely should have ran it too. The only reason I stopped is because of fear of government fees. That's it. They had just nailed me a few days before. But anyway, the good news is, even though his truck was really totaled, my truck was only technically totaled. So I got the value of it and, you know, the salvage cost kind of deducted there. And I got to keep the truck for another 15 years. So that's pretty good. Yeah. And then, let's see, I guess today is also the anniversary of a bunch of Al-Qaeda terrorists in America conspiring in a motel down the street from NSA headquarters. Somehow with complete impunity to go about their business. No matter who got what wire transfer or whose cell phone called whose cell phone. Whose cell phone had called the Yemen switchboard house. And like that. It's also the anniversary of that. All right, cool. Oh, I know. There was one more thing I meant to say about taking care of business stuff. And that was that I'm giving a speech on the 10th of October in Dallas-Fort Worth. Which is cool. It's not going to be in Dallas. It's going to be in Fort Worth. That's what they told me. I think I have the link here, don't I? Where is it? I guess I don't have it. Well, they sent it to me. It's, the Millennial Institute, something like that? Let me see if I can find it on Twitter for you here. Cause they were tweeting it out here. And I followed them. I'm not finding it. Wasn't that it? Millennial? Oh, see, probably if I spelled it right, that might help. Let me see. No, that doesn't help. Alright, well, anyway. I'm giving a speech for some young libertarians. If you go look at my Twitter feed from yesterday or the day before that or something, you'll find it. And I'll have more details, but it's going to be me and Hornberger, Angela Keaton, and Ted Galen Carpenter from Cato as well. Up there doing all foreign policy for young Ron Paulians up there in Fort Worth. October the 10th, in case you want to come.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Hey, did y'all see the new Adelson article? It's in, New York Magazine? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Number six says, Cheney ought to run. Cheney and Cotton ought to run. Hell yeah, that's what I'm saying, too. If you're so smart, how come you're not running for president? That's what conservatives want. Yes, the one linked on antiwar.com today. It's in the frontline section today on antiwar.com about Adelson's plan to buy a Republican. And part of it is he learned the lesson of his mistake from last time, which was backing Newt Gingrich because he liked him so much, but refusing to understand. Nobody else likes Newt Gingrich, dude. Only you. And so all he did was help Newt tear Mitt Romney down so bad that it hurt Romney, which I think Obama was going to win anyway. But the one valuable thing I learned out of that article, I think, other than how self-aware the Israel lobby is, how bad it looks of how much influence that this lunatic Adelson has in the first place, but also what they say about how unwilling he is to listen to anyone. And so he keeps screwing up all the time and scoring own goals all the time. There's quite a few of those in there. He's sort of the George Lucas of Hillary Clinton of the Israel lobby. Absolutely refuses to listen to anyone give constructive criticism at all. Thank God. Could be that much worse. It even has his friends and associates saying, yeah, we can't wait for the old geezer to kick off so that then, you know, his wife is a lot easier to work with than him. But don't worry, sooner or later he'll fall down dead. I mean, that's what his friends are saying in there. Interesting story there about how a gambling tycoon is trying to decide which Republican to bankroll. And it talks about his fighting there with Jeb and, you know, James Baker, crusty old waspy James Baker getting out of line. Years ago, and then again, actually gave a speech at J Street, which was the greatest sin that Jeb had to try to live down. All this crap is funny. It's amazing to see, really, how much influence people who are perfectly proud to say that they put Israel first. I mean, that's Sheldon Adelson says he's got one issue, his one issue is Israel. That's it. And to see how much influence that guy has in American politics. I mean, remember the scandal, and it was not a fake scandal. Parts of it were fake, but there, at the core, there was a very real scandal about Chinese government-associated money helping to re-elect Bill Clinton. Not that it really would have made a difference with Bob Dole, other than it would have spared us the Bush years. But, you know, oh my God, those little yellow communists intervening in our election, putting their money in our political process, that's a scandal. Just like it would be a scandal, you know, if there's a lot of American money messing around in Chinese politics. Not that they have elections over there or anything. But, you know, America, you see American NGOs bankrolling protest movements in Hong Kong and things like that. But anyway, point being, when it's the Israelis or people who say, oh yeah, no, screw America, I'm an Israel first, or, and make no secret of it whatsoever, then, for some reason, that's perfectly fine. You know, and the article really goes into the partisan nature of it, too, and this is something that I think Adelson has really helped to accomplish, and Obama, for his part, I guess, has helped to accomplish it, too, and that is really the turning of Israel into such a partisan issue. And I don't know. Frankly, I don't know how any Republican who's not just completely caught up in, you know, the rapture coming true any day now or whatever, can look at the Republicans and not just think what a pathetic bunch of worms they are when their highest, you know, stated principle is loyalty to a foreign power. It's crazy, isn't it? Oh, yeah, by the way, did I mention Jason Leopold's going to be on the show here in a little while? And he's going to talk about the CIA and your eye holes dictating what the movie scripts say. And then Jack Murchison is going to be on, speaking of Hillary and the Israel lobby, Jack Murchison is going to be on to talk about Hillary Clinton's big speech at the Brookings Institution. You know, the Sabin Center, named for Haim Sabin, the billionaire, another self-made man, apparently, like Adelson. He's an Israeli. He's not an American. Maybe he's a dual citizen, but he's actually an Israeli, unlike Adelson. But he made all his money, I think, most of it anyway, from the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, which came out after I was not a kid anymore, and I always thought were pretty stupid, really. But anyway, so he's the guy that made the billions off of that. He invested in the Brookings Institution, which is kind of the center-left Democratic-type think tank for foreign policy, and bought it out. And you might remember his name because he's the guy that was the subject of a conversation between an Israeli spy and the American Congresswoman Jane Harman when they were saying that if Jane Harman would help to intervene to get the indicted Israeli spies from AIPAC, Rosen and Weissman, Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman, if she would intervene with the Justice Department to help get them off, then they would intervene with Nancy Pelosi, and they would have Haim Sabin threaten to withhold all funds from the Democratic Party unless Pelosi would agree to make Jane Harman the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, of the House Intelligence Committee. And probably, I don't know, but, you know, we know that for a fact, we don't know the counterfactual, but we do know for a fact Pelosi didn't do it because the NSA warned her that, hey, we overheard this plot being hatched, so if they come to you with this threat, don't go along with it. They should have waited around to see what she said. But anyway, so there's you know, a little bit of a clue about Haim Sabin's role with Israeli intelligence and getting their dirty work done here when need be. Okay, I'll waddle in, she said. And what's funny is then she also went to bat for the White House, defending them, the Bush White House, for the wiretapping program on everybody else, on you and me, all in violation of the law. This was before they even pretended to authorize it by law, back then when it was outright, you know, illegal. And she defended all of that. And Alberto Gonzalez actually was saying, yeah, we really need Jane on the NSA issue. And so apparently her influence really did help with getting Rosanna Weissman off. And where the prosecution ended up dropping the charges. And then she turned around and complained, oh, boo-hoo, the NSA is wiretapping me. But they weren't illegally wiretapping her. They were quite legally wiretapping an Israeli spy who happened to be on the phone with Jane Harman, the American congressman. And then so she challenged the Jeff Stein, the journalist that broke the story, to a fun run. And the rest of the media went, oh, isn't that cute? And then the scandal was over. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours, max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I've got Jason Leopold. He is the co-author with Kai Henderson of this new piece at Vice News, Tequila, Painted Pearls, and Prada, How the CIA Helped Produce Zero Dark 30. And that was, of course, the mainstream propaganda flick about the killing of Osama bin Laden that came out, I guess, a couple of years ago now. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Jason?
Hey, Scott. Good to be with you.
Very good to have you here. Again, with the Freedom of Information Act, you got the documents. It's all about, it's a great illustration, I think, of the CIA's relationship with the media's relationship with the CIA, how easygoing it all is so much of the time, apparently, that kind of thing. First of all, I guess tell us, who's Mark Bull and how did he get this job?
Yes, well, Mark Bull is a former journalist, investigative journalist. He's written for Mother Jones, The Nation, Playboy magazine, and he is also the Oscar award-winning screenwriter and a producer. He is the screenwriter of The Hurt Locker. So that is, what was his big movie. Co-produced that with Catherine Bigelow, who is the director of that movie and an Oscar Award winner in her own right. And these documents that I received, just to sort of characterize them for your listeners, they are CIA Inspector General reports, two reports. One report is about former agency director Leon Panetta and disclosures that he made, classified information that he revealed in the presence of Mark Bull after bin Laden was killed. The other report is a potential ethics violation, violations involving Hollywood filmmakers. That is a separate report and investigation that the CIA Inspector General did to determine how its officers interacted with the filmmakers, Mark Bull and Catherine Bigelow, and whether they violated ethics by accepting gifts. And both reports had conclusions in which the Inspector General determined that there were potential violations of federal law, and the matters were both referred to the Justice Department for prosecution. In the case of Leon Panetta, it was the disclosure of classified information, and in the case of the ethics violation, it was potential bribery of government officials and witnesses. The Justice Department declined to prosecute in both cases and referred the matter back to CIA for administrative action.
And which then took place swiftly and severely, right?
Well, no. With the CIA on the ethics side, with the ethics violations, basically what the CIA did is it issued some new ethics guidelines and policies for its officers whenever they deal with Hollywood. And one thing that, stands out in this Inspector General report on the potential ethics violations is that the officers who interacted with Mark Bull and Catherine Bigelow while they were making this movie about the hunt for bin Laden and the fact that the U.S. killed him, was that they had no idea they were given no guidance on ethics. So, for example, what's really fascinating about these documents is that it does not just show how they interacted with Mark Bull and Catherine Bigelow, and does not just show how the CIA had a hand in drafting the script and co-producing this movie. It shows that the filmmakers showered the CIA officers, at least 10 National Clandestine Service officers, with gifts ranging from expensive bottles of tequila to fake pearl earrings, which at the time when Catherine Bigelow gave an officer pearl earrings, it, I'm sure that the officer did not realize that they were fake, and, you know, expensive dinners. And so it's very rich in detail. Now, let me just add that the role that the CIA had with, you know, with this movie, there were some details that were already known. What I'm revealing that's new here is that I'm revealing that the fact that these reports have never been released. These are previously unreleased reports. And the reports, you know, describe the extent to which the CIA was involved in this film. The investigation into Leon Panetta's disclosures is dated March 2014, so just about a year, a little more than a year ago, and the ethics report is September 2013. So these reports have never been released. They do provide incredible new detail showing how far and how involved the CIA was with the creation of this movie.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing about how on one hand, they're willing to basically, it sounds like, let the CIA write the whole script, more or less. But then I know that there were at least a few who had tried to follow up with the movie makers here who had said, yeah, but, you know, did you check these facts? I mean, to what extent did you do journalism to verify that the things you put in this movie are true? And they go, oh, it's just a movie. Oh, it's just a movie. But
right.
At the same time, of course, the whole point of the movie is they're trying to tell you this is the way it happened. We know because the CIA told us.
Yeah, it's again, you know, it's what's really interesting about this is that the documents show there's a great time. By the way, let me just add that there's a great timeline in these documents. It's actually in my story as an image, you know, as we sort of posted it prominently. But there's a great timeline in here, and it shows that Mark Bull read the script over the phone to the CIA's Office of Public Affairs. Now, the Office of Public Affairs is the liaison with the entertainment industry. He read the script over the phone. They objected to several scenes that were in the script in which Mark Bull wrote that detainees were interrogated with dogs or dogs were present in the interrogation room, that detainees were being punched and kicked, and that CIA officers were partying on a roof of a building and shooting off guns. And the CIA, in these documents, it says CIA officers would never do such a thing. So he took that out. He took that out of his script. So, excuse me, it's a great example of how the how the agency really, really did play a role in this. And, you know, the question also becomes is, you know, who was helping who? You know, was it the CIA helping them, or is it, you know, the Bigelow and Bull helping the CIA? You know, I think it worked both ways. On one hand, the CIA and the Obama administration really wanted to get their, you know, their narrative out there about, you know, Bin Laden. And Bigelow and Bull really, really wanted access. They wanted access to the agency.
All right, y'all. We got to take this break. Hold it right there. We'll be right back with Jason Leopold reporting for Vice.com. Tequila, Painted Pearls, and Prada. How the CIA helped produce Zero Dark 30. Back in a minute.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, I meant to call Jason during the break on the Skype, see if we can get a little better audio quality. So I'm trying now after the show's already begun. Okay, cool. Here, let me hang up this thing. We'll try this. All right, Jason, welcome back. Let's see how you sound.
Sound good on this end. How am I sounding there?
Oh, yeah, way better than your cell phone. Very good. We'll go on like this. Hey, so, the commercial, it got in our way. But we're discussing how the CIA helped write, basically, the screenplay for Zero Dark 30, which is the dramatization of the raid on Osama bin Laden's house. And, of course, I think we actually skipped all this. We're in the very interesting nitty gritty details here, but we sort of missed the real meta narrative here, whatever you call it, the larger narrative here, which is torture. Not that you miss it in the article. I'm just saying so far in the interview, torture led us to bin Laden. Thank goodness for torture. And every time that we had a real debate about torture and it started coming to a head, yet always, and it's happening again right now. You always have these guys come with this full court press saying, hey, torture saved American lives. That's their narrative. Because we tortured this guy, he admitted this thing, and that's what led us to that guy. But now we know that nothing to do with a courier led to Osama bin Laden. It was a Pakistani intelligence official or a general who walked right into CIA headquarters and handed him right over.
Right, exactly.
The whole thing about the courier was a lie, not just that they tortured somebody into admitting that it was, you know, you should follow this courier, and never mind the entire, you know, fiction in the movie about how they follow the white truck down the highway and all their crap they made up.
Right, right. Well, I think that, there's many good points that you made here. And let me just say, as part of this narrative, where, you know, this is a multi-layered narrative. What everyone should know is that Mark Bohl and Catherine Bigelow began working with the CIA in 2010. So before bin Laden was killed, they were actually working with the CIA on a movie called Tora Bora. And it was about the fact that, how the CIA let bin Laden slip through its fingers, after 9/11. Mark Bohl contacts the CIA in April of 2011, and says he's traveling to Afghanistan and he's contacting the CIA the way, as Leon Panetta requested, if he ever intended to go there, and he's making that call. 2 weeks later, the CIA in this joint operation kills bin Laden. So Mark Bohl scraps this script and starts working on Zero Dark 30. What's important to note about this time frame, Scott, is that this and the way that the CIA, provided Bohl and Bigelow with this intelligence information about the operation is that this also took place when the Senate Intelligence Committee was investigating the efficacy of the CIA's program. And the CIA's torture program. And what the Senate Intelligence Committee ultimately found out, is that, the use of torture did not result in any unique, or valuable intelligence. No intelligence that could be deemed actionable. And one thing that they noted was that, the, torture of several detainees that the CIA claims, you know, led to the courier that led to bin Laden, did not pan out. It was not true. So on one hand, you had the CIA that obviously wanted to get its narrative out there. And how better to get your narrative out than to use Hollywood to make a movie about how torture played a role in killing bin Laden, leading us to bin Laden, then his death, and get that out to a mass audience. You know, Zero Dark Thirty made in a worldwide box office over $130 million. So, it was so, intense in terms of what was taking place behind the scenes that, you know, Dianne Feinstein, who was the chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, when she learned that the CIA was, you know, providing details and had worked with Bigelow and Bull at the same time her committee was writing this report and giving them this narrative about bin Laden, she took the unprecedented step of writing to the president of Sony Pictures and basically saying that they had an obligation to correct the record on what this film portrayed. So, that's the context in all of this. And you make a very, you know, good and important point about torture. This week, we are seeing the release of a book called Rebuttal. This is a book that contains essays from former top CIA officials in which they rebut the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on the CIA's torture program. And so this has been going on, obviously. You know, this story is not going away. This issue of torture, this debate about torture, who controls the narrative, you know, continues. And these documents that, I obtained through this FOIA, Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, is another part of that, you know, that narrative, another wrinkle to the story. And it plays a very, very important part.
You know what's interesting, too? They did a movie that was just exactly the same movie. I'm pretty sure with the same torture narrative. I'm not sure what the differences were. But for the Learning Channel or the Discovery Channel or one of those. And it has the heroic red-haired CIA lady and everything. It's the exact same movie, pretty much. One I'm talking about? Have you sued for the documents on that script, too?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually, requested a number of different documents related to, you know, the work that the CIA has done, their roles with, you know, with Hollywood. And I think that, look, you know, I'm not breaking new ground here. You know, the CIA's role with Hollywood, their work with Hollywood goes back decades. There's been books written about it. But it's always interesting to see, you know, the evolution of that, if anything has changed. I mean, like I said, certainly these documents are fascinating for many, many different reasons, as well as the fact that it led to the creation of this, you know, new ethics policy, that the CIA put out. But I'm still waiting on everything else. You know, Scott, that, documents, it takes a long time to get them. I'm a very patient man, and hopefully that will eventually come through.
Yeah. Hey, it's a virtue. It certainly works out for you and your reporting. In fact,
thank you.
There's been, I don't know, not to change the subject, but there's been at least a handful of just profiles of you and the journalism that you're doing because of how far out in front of everybody else you are on so much of this stuff. So, that really speaks to the value of the work you're doing. So,
thank
I don't have
you.
To tell you.
It.
They already are all telling you. All right. So,
thanks.
Yeah. Now, the thing about, all these gifts that they accepted, it's sort of, is beside the point. The real point is how much the CIA influenced the way that they wrote the movie and produced it and made them look and all that. I mean, that's the real meat of it. But then again, as you say, looks like they're breaking the law. Going both ways here, really, coming and going. And of course, then there's complete, impunity and a complete lack of accountability. The IG you said recommended it to the Justice Department and they said, nah.
Yeah. And I think that that is very important to note in the context of how the Obama administration has aggressively pursued the leak of classified information, the disclosure of classified information, how the administration has aggressively prosecuted individuals for disclosing this information. But, you know, I think these documents are another more evidence to show that not all leaks are equal, Scott. You know, this was Leon Panetta. There was a disclosure of classified info.
Yep.
It's interesting also because he, as director of the CIA, he has this sort of instant declassification authority. He could say something will be instantly, you know, declassified. So, the fact
it is kind of interesting that they investigated that at all. I mean, after all, there's official leaks in the New York Times and Washington Post every day, that kind of thing. What was different about him leaking this than those kind of situations?
You know, the issue about this was the fact that, I left that out, was that, Mark Bowl, what happened was that after bin Laden was killed, maybe about 6 weeks later, less than a month later, the CIA held an award ceremony, what they call the bin Laden award ceremony. It was held at CIA headquarters in a tent, outside of headquarters, attended by about 1,300 people, including the Navy SEALs. Mark Bowl was invited to this. He secured an invitation to this classified award ceremony. He does not hold the security clearance. His presence there concerned a number of people, who were present, who were, you know, at this award ceremony. And they found that, on one hand, Leon Panetta, you know, did he extend an invitation to Mark Bowl? Did he know he was there? There was conflicting information about that. But, there was a, you know, when Leon Panetta was giving a speech, his speech contained classified information. He identified the Navy SEALs, you know, by name, the ground commander by name, you know, information that would otherwise be classified. They found that his speech itself was classified as secret when it should have been top secret. So there were, you know, there was a complete breakdown safeguarding, you know, information here. And so they decided like, oh, wow, we need to investigate. One, how did Mark Bowl get here? How did he get an invitation? Mm. Who authorized it? What was really fascinating is that when they was confronted with this, you know, when Leon Panetta was confronted with, did you know that Mark Bowl would be here? He said, no. In fact, I wouldn't be able to identify Mark Bowl anyway because I've never met him. Well, guess what? The Inspector General found that Leon Panetta's story didn't check out because a year earlier, he did meet Mark Bowl. Hmm. He also met Catherine Bigelow. He sat with them at a table at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And included with these documents is the seating chart of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, showing that Leon Panetta sat with Bowl and Bigelow. And it was at this Correspondents' Dinner that he said to them, if you ever need anything, you need any help from the agency with your, you know, with your movies, with this bin Laden movie, give us a call. And so that's sort of why they, you know, part of the reason why they kind of, you know, continue to push this. I did note that the, you know, the oddity of it is that, you know, as director of the CIA, he's considered what one would call an original classification authority. So he could also just kind of instantly declassify.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the information that he revealed, should have been top secret contained, Defense Department information, particularly or specifically some NSA information. So, and Mark Bowl, you know, was there to hear it all.
Hmm. Yeah, it's still kind of puzzling because, you know, usually there's only two kinds of leaks. The kind that the official government, somebody on the level of Panetta or, you know, the White House, wants in the media, which is perfectly fine, or, you know, someone heroically trying to tell the truth about government crimes to the American people, and then they go to prison, and they're treated, you know, they're charged with espionage and this kind of thing. And now, obviously, this didn't go that far, but it seems like, man, there must have been a political vendetta somewhere. Somebody had a vendetta, but maybe between the National Intelligence Director and Panetta or something, for this to go that far against Panetta, or Because I'm trying to think, like, the counterfactual. They just invited Bob Woodward to that thing to write it up for the Washington Post, or Walter Pincus or David Ignatius or something. That would have been just perfectly fine, right? Or is it that there were so many people there watching? Or
yeah, but, well, actually, that's an interesting point. And one of the issues that came up is that journalists obviously don't get the same sort of access that, you know, these Hollywood filmmakers get. They certainly get access, Scott. We know that. We know that Walter Pincus, for example, gets plenty of leaks and access to, you know, to the CIA. However, this was something that was just so unique and extraordinary because Mark Bull, the screenwriter, was invited by, you know, the top officials. He was meeting with top officials. He, you know, these officials said that they didn't consider him to be a journalist. They considered him to be, you know, a Hollywood screenwriter. So he was, you know, he was treated differently. But, you know, it's very clear that, as I noted, that, you know, not all leaks, not all disclosures are treated the same. And this was still a disclosure of classified information, to in the presence of someone who was not clear to receive it. And, there was no accountability for that. Whereas, you know, the disclosure of a name, right? The name of an officer to someone at the New York Times, mm-hmm. By John Kiriakou, and that name was never printed, you know, resulted in John Kiriakou, former CIA officer, being, sent to prison, for 2 years. And they even pursued him on espionage charges. So, and the same with David Petraeus, the former head of the CIA, although he pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor. So, you know, it just comes down to, you know, the fact that, they chalk this up as a mistake, an oversight, disorganization, and that was it.
All right. Well, listen, I'm sorry I've kept you over time, and I know you got to go, but thanks so much for your time and great reporting here, Jason, as always.
Thanks, Scott. Always appreciate it and always great to speak with you.
All right, y'all. That's Jason Leopold. He's at news.vice.com. Tequila, Painted Pearls, and Prada, how the CIA helped produce Zero Dark 30. We'll be right back in a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. All right, so there's more of that Leopold interview. I kept interviewing him into the break there, as I am often wont to do. Oh, man. Well, it was just going to be a remark more than a question anyway, I guess. I meant to bring up how what would have been nice in that movie is if they showed the CIA torturing guy saying, "Tell me about your friendship with Saddam Hussein before I pull out some more of your fingernails." You know, because that's what the torture program was mostly about. I think they probably tortured some people and said, "Tell us about plans for attacks," to a degree, but mostly it was about, "Tell us about Saddam. Tell us about that time you and all your friends took a field trip to Iraq." And then you got a bunch of jihadists going, "Huh? Ah! Wait, what? Ah! Oh, Saddam. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Saddam's my best friend. Please stop hurting me. Chemical weapons? Yep. Not only did he give us chemical weapons, he taught us how to make chemical weapons. Please, please make the pain stop. See, torture works. You can ask a million and counting dead Iraqis. Did torture work? Well, it sure did work for coming up. And you know, this is the puzzling thing to me. Why can't they just make up lies? Hey, look, this jihadist guy said he was friends with Saddam. Why they gotta torture a guy into making up an easily disprovable lie? Why not just make it up? Why not just make up the captive and make up the story? Instead of beating it out of some innocent dude or somebody who is guilty of something entirely different than what they're trying to get him to say. Anyway. Why torture? Because it's fun for torturers. And just because you personally don't think it sounds like a riot doesn't mean that some people aren't into that kind of thing. Some of them are. All right. So what is going on with the House of Randy? So GOP revolt delays Iran deal vote. And the deal was the two houses of Congress both were going to pass and could supposedly easily pass resolutions against the Iran deal. Only now they need 60 votes in the Senate, so they're not going to get that. Not only are they not going to override the veto, apparently now they're going to get filibustered. It's right on the line. They very well may get filibustered and be unable to pass the deal in the Senate. But then things are falling apart against the House resolution against it, too. And Jason Ditz has this article at news.antiwar.com. GOP revolt delays Iran deal vote. And the best I understand, I don't want to read the whole thing to you. The best I understand it is they're complaining that the resolution says that they have to see every last little piece of paper associated with this deal. Well, but that's not really how it works. And of course, they're trying to make a mountain out of a molehill about the secret side deals, as though now Yuki Amano and the IAEA are the sock puppets of the Iranians and are only just looking for, you know, escape hatches and loopholes to let the Iranians get away with making a nuke now. When in fact, what it is these are confidential agreements, and I think probably in this case they should go ahead and try to negotiate with the Iranians to go ahead and release them anyway, because all it is the protocol for the inspection. And it's not secret because it's a terrible evil hidden in the secrecy. It's just secret because that's how they do it. It's a confidential agreement for how the safeguards are to, the inspections under the safeguards are specifically to be carried out. And in this case, I don't even think it's a secret about any of the actual nuclear facilities. Now we're only talking about the so-called suspicious sites, which are all a bunch of made-up nonsense anyway. You know, Robert Kelly, the former IAEA chief inspector, has debunked these accusations about the Parchin military facility numerous times. So has Gareth Porter, the great reporter. And, but anyway, so it's basically meaningless, but it's something for them to glom onto. And, oh, it's a side deal, as though, you know, it's outflanking the deal. Which they say is so horrible, when all it is these are the details of the implementation of the deal is all it is. And everybody already knows they're going to go to Parchin and find nothing anyway, because the whole story is a bunch of crap anyway. But that's their excuse now. No, wait a minute. So I'm off my point on my tangent about how stupid the Parchin allegations are. Because see, here's the point then. The congressmen, the Republican congressmen are saying that, if I can characterize it correctly, that since all of the documents have not been put forward and the original resolution said they get to see everything before they have their up or down vote, now they don't want to have their up or down vote. They're going to cross their arms and pout and insist that they see all the so-called side deals that they don't get to see. And that's kind of interesting to me. I wonder, I mean, it's only mildly interesting, actually, now that I think about it. I wonder whether this is a John Boehner ploy to save the embarrassment and not pass a House deal either. We'll just come up with other things to do, pass other poison pill resolutions and amendments and new sanctions and whatever they can in a different way. But as long as they're not going to get the resolution through the Senate, they're just going to go ahead and, use this as the excuse to scotch the deal in the House? I guess that's it. I don't know. But anyway, at least the deal apparently will be implemented. We'll see whether they can sabotage it with new sanctions and all. I wouldn't put it past them to, you know, be able to figure out how to put together a veto-proof majority for new sanctions on, you know, based on whatever excuse. So, you know, I saw Charles Schumer today talking about Iranian terrorism in Iraq. Really? Well, he supported the war to import the Iranian revolution to Iraq and give them and their Dawa and Skiri sock puppets control of the government in Baghdad, as well as the capital of Baghdad, and kick all the Sunnis out of the capital, millions of them. And now he wants to complain about Iranian terrorism, and what are they doing now? Well, right now, they're fighting the Islamic State. And Charles Schumer's complaining? When all the Revolutionary Guard is doing nowadays is rounding up George Bush's and Charles Schumer's old allies in the Bada Brigade and giving them rifles and pointing at Islamic State and saying, shoot. It's just like this whole crisis about Russia right now. Oh my God, Russia admits that they've got special forces on the ground advising the Syrians in fighting the Islamic State. So cry me a river. I mean, whatever, I hate Russia. It's a government. I don't mean the place and the people, I mean, or the country. I just mean the government of the place. It's a government. It shouldn't exist. It shouldn't do things any more than my government or your government should do things. I'm completely against all things all governments do. But in the scheme of things, America just put their force of less than 100 mythical moderates into the field in Syria, and our allies, according to Mitchell Prothero and McClatchy newspapers, our allies, the Turks, told the al-Nusra Front, hey, kill these guys. And the al-Nusra Front killed them, most of them, and took the rest hostage and destroyed the entire effort by the DOD to train up some mythical moderates to go fight the Islamic State. Now, Ayman al-Zawahiri has put out a podcast saying that he doesn't believe in the Islamic State, that it's not a caliphate according to the book. It's just, you know, a pseudo-state, whatever. But then he says, but you know who's worse? The Shiites and the Crusaders and the secularists. And so Zawahiri recommends that al-Qaeda should work with the Islamic State against their mutual enemies. And I told you guys before, man, about that article about the human rights lawyer Stanley Cohen, who had some contacts among some jihadists, and he almost healed the rift between al-Qaeda and the Islamic State in the process of negotiating to try to free one of the American hostages over there. And but in order to do so, he really demonstrated, the whole thing fell apart at the last minute, but he demonstrated just how easy it would be for al-Qaeda and the Islamic State to come back together again. And but now you're supposed to be mad that Assad hasn't lost completely to al-Qaeda and the Islamic State yet, according to, you know, the news. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I guess there is one good thing about Rand Paul being horrible and doing so horrible. Well, that's the silver lining, that he's doing so horrible. I was worried, man, because when I first started pointing out that, man, this guy's horrible, people would say, no, you are horrible. You just don't understand politics. You don't understand what's going on here. Rand Paul has a secret plan to infiltrate politics and gain a lot of power, and then he'll reveal himself to be just as libertarian as you and me. That's how you play politics, Horton. You just don't get it, buddy. And I thought, man, huh, I wonder, how bad can he sell out? How moderate can he be and still keep the excitement going, you know? And it turns out, man, not very. That was obviously his calculation was, hey, man, these people are going to stay loyal no matter what, so I can move as far to the right as I want, and I'll be able to count on them, but then I'll recruit a bunch of new right-wingers to my cause, too. Not that libertarians are the left, but the right are to the right of us, in a sense. But anyway, it depends on how you calculate all that crap. I'm sort of a Nolan chart type myself. But anyway, it didn't work. It didn't work. So I think he's averaging in the new CNN poll 3%. He's way down there with Pataki and Christie. And so at least there's that. I mean, my argument was, well, he should be principled anyway. That's how to do the right thing, and that's the best political strategy anyway. But I had to allow the possibility that maybe I'm wrong that that's the best political strategy. Maybe if he runs as a Republican, that Republicans will buy it. But probably not, because why would they when they got Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and all these other Republicans? What he should have been doing was, you know, pick up where his dad left off, right? Pick up the ball there and run with that. Not, you know, start slowly walking backwards. And it's costing him. And I'm sorry for I always talk about Rand Paul on the show, but I'm kind of obsessed, and maybe it's unreasonable. Because, you know, I do understand that there he's not secretly really Ron Paul on the inside. He really is who he is. And that's the problem with him. I mean, I'm the first to tell you that. But then on the other hand, how obvious is it? How obvious must it be to him right now that, man, I'd be doing a lot better if I was better on this stuff? Getting worse on everything isn't helping. Maybe getting better would help. Maybe being good on the Islamic State and a new war against it instead of horrible would be beneficial. Maybe those politics could play out. By this point in 2008, Ron Paul was already a superstar. It was, you know, money bomb time, shock the world time. And he was just coming from the House of Representatives. And right now, I mean, just look at the polls. All the Republicans, they like Trump and they like, is it Carson? I always wanted to call him Cardin, but that's the senator. It's Carson, the doctor, the black guy. And why? Because they're the outsiders. Rand, in the first debate, the first thing he did was carve out the spot of I am the most loyal to the party. And I denounce Trump for even leaving open the possibility that he would run as a third party candidate against the party. I am the most Mitch McConnell-ish guy up here, I swear to God. And how far did that get him? And his whole shtick obviously should be, yes, it's true I'm a senator, but I'm just a freshman senator, and I just got here from Kentucky, man. I'm not a Washington, D.C. guy, and I'm completely against A, B, C, D through Z, right? I mean, just go off against every horrible thing about the state. And say, you listen to this guy Trump, he hadn't said the word freedom once, because he doesn't know nothing about it. He doesn't believe in it. He's not interested in it. Here's what we gotta do, is oppose this, and that. It'll be great. You know, of course, starting with all the worst stuff first. And there'll be huge excitement there. And the reason why that I can't get over it is because I know what all the Rand apologists have been telling me all along. This guy grew up on Mises and Rothbard. This guy is, you know, he'll go off the cuff and quote some Madison for you and stuff like this, you know, in good context. So we know he knows better, but he just, I don't know. Let's see. I guess maybe I gotta stop being good on Syria and Libya now. The last two things that he's good on, he's gotta go ahead and stop that. Maybe that'll do the trick. And someone tweeted me the other day and said, nah, man, you don't know. The theme going around on Facebook is he's playing a really long game. He's just waiting until all the other candidates drop out. And then, when it's really whittled down to just him and Jeb and Trump, then he's gonna come out swinging. Yeah, I think it's going to be way too late by then. And the question then will be whether he can even keep his Senate seat. And meanwhile, what did Ron Paul do that was such a big deal anyway? What was the big deal? He spoke the simple truth. He wasn't afraid to say the truth. Oh, what? All these things that these guys are saying? That's not right. Let me tell you, here's how it is. And he was right. And regular, non-political, regular people said, hey, that guy is being decent and honest with me. He's respecting my intelligence and he's trying to tell me the truth. They could just see it. They joined up the Ron Paul revolution. Snap of their fingers. Hope for America. And so I'm sorry I can't stop talking about Rand. It's just that I can't get over how obvious it must be even to him at this point that, you know what? Being bad on a bunch of stuff didn't win a bunch of horrible people to his cause. And maybe it's too late, you know, to win the libertarians back, but, you know, the platform is easy. Just go read Ron Paul's archive at antiwar.com. Ron Paul writes every week. Every week he writes, and almost always it's relevant to foreign policy or the police state. Almost always. And he's great on everything. I mean, pretty much great on everything. So, there's your platform. Original.antiwar.com/Paul. Go and just learn that. Pick up a map of the Middle East and refer to it regularly as you read along. Anyway, I'm sorry, man, that Rand Paul thing. 9 times out of 10 people turn to this show, I'm complaining about Rand Paul. Oh, but such possibilities. Such possibilities there. All right. Well, anyway. Sorry, I meant to also bash Justin Amash for coming out against the Iran deal under some technical excuse, pretending that it should be a treaty. When we already have a treaty, the non-proliferation treaty. This is just a deal to stop our economic war against them that's wholly illegitimate. Why do you need a treaty for that? Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place. It features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Up next is Jack Merkinson. He's got this piece at Salon.com today about Hillary Clinton's big speech at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to the show. Jack, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. Appreciative of you joining us on the show today. And, you know, it's fun. Part of what's fun about the election season is watching the politicians, on one hand, giving their pitch to the donors with all the money, And then on the other hand, trying to pretend they never said any of that to everybody else that they're trying to get to vote for them, that they're trying to persuade with all that money to support them. Oftentimes those interests diverge. And so it's just like this, right? They give one big stump speech about one thing. Then they go to the think tank and they say a bunch of stuff that, not that she would necessarily contradict herself out on the road, but she would never bring this stuff up and talk this way out on the road. But here at Brookings, she lets them know, well, what? Tell us.
Well, you know, she was giving a speech about the diplomatic deal that the Obama administration and a few other countries have struck with Iran, you know, and sort of the overall headline, I guess, was that she supports the deal, which, as I said, by this point is hardly, you know, an act of extreme political courage, given that the deal's implementation is basically assured, since there's no chance that it will be overturned by Congress because they have all the votes to override any presidential veto if they block the deal.
And so, in fact, if anything, it's cowardice, because we all know she'd like to oppose it, but she can't because she was Obama's Secretary of State. She has to support this. And so she's giving in and cowering instead of standing up for her horrible beliefs.
Right. You know, I mean, I have no idea what is in Hillary Clinton's mind about what she truly feels about the Iran deal. But I would imagine that if the political situation was different, she might view this as a good opportunity to break with Obama and set a different path. But I think you're right that she feels like she has no choice but to stand behind, you know, this very major portion of Obama's diplomatic legacy. But
right.
On the other hand, she did want to send different signals about what she would do. And as is often the case with Hillary Clinton, and this was really the major thrust of the thing that I wrote, those signals were invariably very, very hawkish. signals. You know, Hillary Clinton, throughout her political career, has made a point of being very, very supportive of going to war or of military intervention. And a lot of her speech really backed that up. She talked about expanding the military presence of the United States in the region around Iran. She explicitly said that she would not hesitate to attack Iran militarily if there were signs that they were developing a nuclear weapon, which is, you know, a pretty standard thing for politicians in the United States to say. But when you step back and think about it, if Iran went around and said, well, if the United States does this thing we don't like, we will bomb them, the United States would have a bit of a problem with that.
Well, and of course, you could imagine her saying something along those lines, but in a much easier way. Like, hey, look, you know, we can have confidence that this deal, it's a good deal and whatever. Now, look, if on the off chance that things go wrong, then there are still other options. And that's still right. Horrible, and I'm still against it, right? But instead, she chooses to be as belligerent as possible about it. You know, don't forget, we had the H-bomb, you know, basically.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, and that is really in line with the stances that she has taken for decades, certainly at least since she became a senator in her own right. Although, you know, she her husband, when he was in office, was certainly not averse to using the military. And there was no sign that she ever opposed any of that. But certainly once she got to the Senate, she infamously backed the war in Iraq. She, you know, which was a big mistake of hers, but, you know, she comes down time and time again on the side of war. And when she was Secretary of State, if you look at her history, every single time there was any debate about whether or not the Obama administration was going to intervene someplace, she was always, always on the side of intervention. She, in terms of escalating the war in Afghanistan, in terms of intervening in Syria, and especially in terms of attacking Libya, which she was really at the heart of and which has become just an unholy disaster in terms of how that turned out.
Yeah, well, for sure. Now, before we get into those, and I want to take them in order, actually, but there's also the matter of her letter. I think it was her letter to Haim Sabin about the BDS movement, how she was going to do everything she could to try to thwart that. Are you familiar with that part of the story?
I'm not completely familiar with that letter, but it's absolutely no surprise to me that she would be taking that stance. You know, I think that that most politicians running for the presidency certainly you know would try to send those signals. But she has also you know been using Israel as another way to break with the Obama administration, which a lot of hardliners on Israel think has been much too hard on Israel. And so she has made a lot of different sort of intimations that she disagrees with the way the Obama administration has dealt with Israel, and that she would have been more publicly diplomatic with Benjamin Netanyahu, and that she would have, you know, that and that she would basically have no daylight publicly between between her public positions and Israel's public positions. And so it's not surprising to me that she would want to send that kind of public signal to one of her biggest donors and biggest supporters.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we remember, I think, from the convention, there was that big, I forgot exactly what the resolution was, but it was something about the occupation where, you know, the whole crowd, it was a voice vote, and the whole crowd, basically two-thirds, at least supermajority type thing, supported the resolution, and then I think it was the mayor of LA was administering the thing, and he looked over for instructions and went ahead and squashed the motion. It was something to criticize me. So this is, and of course the Republicans are completely locked up for the Israel lobby. So if there's any dissent, and there is, there's any dissent about American Israel policy, it, you know, in American politics, it's in the Democratic Party. But again, major schism between what the people at the Brookings Institution want to hear in her speech and what the people on the road want to hear when it comes to that issue, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. You know, I think the past few years you've seen actually a real growth in skepticism, at the very least, about the U.S. relationship with Israel. But in terms of at the elite level, you know, I think that really hasn't happened in the same way.
Yeah. And now I think it was in Glenn Greenwald's piece where he points out a quote of hers where she says, you know, if I thought the Iran deal in any way compromise Israeli security at all, then I would absolutely, you know, oppose it, do anything to stop it, with no mention of American interests even in the statement at all. It's all about Israel, but, you know, in her judgment, this is good for Israel. That's why she supports it only.
Right. Yeah. You know, she, excuse me. You know, she definitely wants to hit that point as hard as she can, you know, and there, I mean, you can see why. There are a lot of very powerful people who are very big supporters of Israel, who are within the Democratic Party, you know, and if you have attained the level that Hillary Clinton has reached in American politics, you are going to be very, very sympathetic to those views. So
yeah,
I didn't even know
she should be embarrassed. She just says it. All right. Now, I'm sorry. I got to put you on hold here. We got to take this break, but we'll be right back, everybody, with Jack Merkinson, from Salon.com right after this. Talking about Hillary's big Brookings speech. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. What Hillary Clinton wants you to forget, but can't help but keep reminding you. Her disastrous record as a war hawk. That's the article at Salon.com. It's by Jack Merkinson. And you were very kind and left out her making up with Bill after Lewinsky over the bombing of Serbia. She called Bill and urged him to bomb. She told Gail Sheehy, her authorized biographer, and that was how they made up again after the big scandal of 98.
Yeah, I didn't go that far back in history.
Yeah, you're very gracious. Yeah, no, you could have. But anyway, so... Yeah, now you mentioned, we talked about, Palestine. I think we pretty much covered that. Or I guess we could talk about, do you know much about what she said or didn't say during, were there one or two different Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip on her watch as Secretary of State? Do you remember?
I think there was one. And I think there was the one just as the Obama administration came in to office, I think.
Right, yeah, we
won't
count that one, because they actually wrapped it up, like, the day before the inauguration or whatever, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but there was one
sure.
in 2012.
Yes, okay.
And then again in 2014, right. So, and then, I guess, whatever role she played in 2012, I don't really remember specifically her doing anything, but I guess she sure as hell didn't make it better, did she?
No, I don't think she did. You know, I mean, there has been... a pretty standard policy in terms of how the United States, you know, deals with Israel, especially during Israeli attacks, you know, going back a ways. And the Obama administration really hasn't deviated that much from that policy. They've had rifts with the Israelis over different things, but in terms of their essential support, you know, or their standing back, you know, when there is a flare up of violence in that in Israel and in Palestine, you know, they haven't really changed what has been the natural American stance. And, you know, I think Hillary Clinton would not have been the one to push for that change during her time in office.
Yeah. All right. Now, you mentioned her role in the Afghan surge, and boy, there's something. It's like the Korean War or some of the forgotten war that nobody remembers or talks about. It was in nobody who was in love with Obama's interest to highlight. And of course, all the war hawks who hate Obama, they still like surges, so they didn't have a problem with it. So it's just the libertarians really complained about it at the time. And but it was really a big deal, right? I mean, she really helped Petraeus and McChrystal politically in their fight against the president to basically just leave him all the way out on a limb by himself, where, you know, then he felt like he had no choice but to compromise and go ahead and do it.
Right. And, you know, she was an enthusiastic, proponent of escalating, the war, you know, and, of course it didn't really work out too well. You know, and but that was really the role that she played throughout her time at the State Department. And that was at the very beginning of the Obama administration. You know, so it was really a key indicator of the kind of role that she would play for the next 4 years.
Yeah. And boy, I mean, who didn't see that coming as soon as she was made Secretary of State? I mean, I could see why Obama didn't want to have her as a senator while he was the president, because that could be a problem. But, man, making her the Secretary of State, that was just, we're destined to, you know, get into some kind of mess or three. And now, yeah, the Libya war, I mean, this is supposedly Obama's only doctrine is don't do stupid stuff. Right. And talk about a war of choice. Let's get rid of Muammar Gaddafi that George W. Bush finally had brought in from the cold and had made a deal with and had normalized relations with.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talk about Afghanistan being the forgotten war. I think Libya even more so. You know, it's like beyond Benghazi, which has become such a sort of, you know, cartoonish, politicized kind of controversy. Nobody ever talks about what actually went on in Libya, which is that, you know, the West invaded and completely destroyed the country. I mean, you know, it's basically it's hardly even a recognizable place anymore. It's been completely upended, you know, and it's directly contributing to a lot of the other problems that we're seeing around the world. Certainly in terms of the refugee crisis in Europe, a lot of these refugees have been coming from Libya, which has become so destabilized from from the Western intervention. And Hillary Clinton was really one of the key players in shaping the decision and the strategy in terms of that invasion. And it's been a huge catastrophe.
Yeah, in fact, there's a recent email where one of her aides, I don't know if it's Sidney Blumenthal or someone who actually works directly for her, is saying, yes, you know, we should coin this, the Clinton Doctrine.
Right.
This is how we do business now. This is her big thing. And in fact, when the Washington Times came out with their four-part series, which I know the Washington Times, you could lump them in with the childish Benghazi coverage a lot of the time, but they did this great four-part series about how Dennis Kucinich, the CIA, and the DOD tried to stop the war and negotiate with Gaddafi's son for a, you know, sub-regime change and a peace deal and whatever. Carter Ham from AFRICOM was in on it, and no one could stop Hillary Clinton. She crushed all their efforts.
And, I mean, I haven't read that.
Oh yeah, no, you got to look at it. It's by Kelly Riddell. Riddell is her last name. Four-part series, great journalism. I know it's the Mooney Times, but really great journalism there.
And after great that journalism happened, can wind up anywhere.
Yeah, yeah, and I went back. Yeah, no, it did in this case. but I went back and checked, and there are Michael Hastings and Josh Rogan and a few other people had all told the same story about how they had, you know, on the two couches in the Oval Office, they had the secretary, the national security advisor and his deputy, the secretary of defense, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff all opposed. And the secretary of defense was the Republican, Robert Gates at the time,
right,
even. So Obama's right flank completely covered. They were all against it. And then on the other side was Hillary Clinton, Samantha Power, and Susan Rice and their deputies. And they said, no, we got to do it to save the poor people, when the Benghazi slaughter was make-believe anyway. It wasn't even going to happen. We're talking the original Benghazi scam, not the second one. And Obama sided with them. Above all reason, and when he had his right flank covered politically to say, hey, all my military men are telling me not to do it, right? And he did it anyway.
I mean, I think overall, certainly what the decisions around Libya highlight is that going to war is always a political choice. Certainly for the United States, you know, despite the rhetoric that's thrown around about how under threat the United States is overwhelmingly the most powerful military force in the history of the planet. You know, and so far more often than not, when the United States decides to go to war, it is making a very political decision. And so I think whatever diplomatic initiatives might have been crushed or stalled, you know, I think when there's a decision made that for whatever reason war has to be waged, if you know, certainly if you look at Iraq, there was, you know, and I remember when they were saying, oh, well, you know, we'll give Saddam 48 hours to get out and then maybe we won't bomb, you know, but of course they were going to bomb because they had already decided that that's what they had to do for a variety of different reasons that we all know about. And so I think in Libya, you know, it was a deeply political decision. And, you know, unfortunately, the world has reaped the consequences of that decision ever since.
Yep. And then, as you mentioned, and tying right in, a segue right in, literally, from the Mujahideen in Libya, taking all of Gaddafi's captured guns, moving on to Mali, and forging a revolution there, and then, but more famously, on to Syria, where they hijacked the Arab Spring uprising there and turned it into a war of bin Ladenites versus the secular coalition government there. Something that she pushed hard, and after she resigned, she complained publicly in the New York Times, threw Obama under the bus for not doing enough to help the mythical moderates over there.
Right. I mean, it's very striking that, you know, she hasn't publicly broken with Obama about that many things, but most of them have been about foreign policy, and most of that has been about how she would have been, quote unquote, tougher, you know, held a harder line than Obama did, and how disappointed she was that he didn't.
Yep.
You know, and Siri is a classic example of that.
Yep. All right, that's Jack Merkinson. He's at Salon.com. What Hillary wants you to forget, her disastrous record as a war hawk. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
See y'all tomorrow.